Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Judge Rovner, can you hear us okay?
Perfectly. Hello, hello.
Hello. So our first case up for oral argument this afternoon is number 25-2235, Goldbert versus Smith. And Ms. Brown.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Ruth Brown for the plaintiffs. The district court's decision here was wrong for three reasons. First, its decision contradicted the Supreme Court's mandate in Hafer v. Malo. Second, the district court overextended cases seeking and claims seeking materially distinguishable relief. And third, it applied an incorrect and inapplicable test. If this court were to allow the district court's decision to stand, that would make the Seventh Circuit an outlier, and it would bring confusion to this court's 11th Amendment case law by importing new factors and considerations that could not be consistently and fairly applied across cases. The claims—
Ms. Brown, I'm going to stop you because I'd like to ask you something, please. Put aside for the moment the part of this suit that is still pending in the district court, okay? We're putting that aside.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the question that I'm going to ask you is only about the claim before us today. Let's suppose that the defendants offered to settle this suit for all of the damages that you asked for. But the defendants and DCFS clearly assert that they will not change any policies, any practices, and they will adjust, continue to pay the juveniles for their damage if they get sued, but they aren't going to make any efforts to place these children more quickly. Does this end the case, Ms. Brown?
Yes, Your Honor, it would end the case because the relief that the plaintiffs are seeking here is money damages from the individual defendants for their personal involvement in constitutional violations. The plaintiffs here are not seeking an injunction. And that's exactly the distinction that makes this a personal capacity action because of the relief sought.
We have cases that say it's not enough just to label it as a monetary damages.
That's correct. What the plaintiff has to do is make clear that they are suing the defendants for their personal involvement in constitutional violations, and that what they're seeking as the outcome of the lawsuit is money damages from the personal assets of the individual defendants for those constitutional violations.
Ms. Brown, I think we can all agree that the law in determining the real party in interest is a bit murky. Other than looking at the damages that you're requesting, what do you think the test is for determining who the real party in interest is?
So the test is to look at the relief. On one side of the line, you have cases that are seeking monetary relief from individual defendants for their personal involvement. And on the other side of the line, what you have are cases where even if the plaintiff nominally lists a state official, what the plaintiff is seeking is relief that only the sovereign state can provide. Things like if the plaintiff is seeking an injunction or if the plaintiff is seeking reinstatement to a job, that only a state official acting as a sovereign could restore that position. Or if the plaintiff, what they're seeking is have a state official transfer the state's ownership in land or property or water rights to a third party or to the plaintiff. Those are the kinds of cases that are official capacity claims, even if the plaintiff has nominally named a state official.
What else besides relief? And relief in the case law is certainly key, but we have cases suggesting that maybe you look at other factors as well. What do you, and not the Fourth Circuit's test, but what do you think those other factors should be? So other than the relief sought, what in the complaint determines who the real party in interest is?
Well, so if the court is trying to figure out what was the intention behind the complaint, it can look at, you know, our, like, for example, in our case, the claim is lodged against the individual defendants, not the state. So you can look, and then there are allegations of personal involvement, which would be superfluous if the attempt was, if the purpose of the lawsuit was instead to sue the state for a remedy provided by the state.
You have a lot of allegations about the policies of DCFS and not carrying out those policies. What do we do with those in making the assessment?
So the Supreme Court has said in cases like Ex parte Young and Scherr and in Hafer that when a state official acts in violation of the Constitution, the federal Constitution, they're stripped of their official character and subject to the consequences of their conduct. And so that principle holds true whether you're talking about a line officer who uses excessive force or a supervisor who enacts a policy of excessive force. The test is the same. And so just as the court explained in Orr, whether or not the allegations are addressing policymakers is not the determination. The question is, what kind of relief is the plaintiff seeking and what is the purpose of the allegations about policy?
So I guess that's what my question really is. A lot of your allegations here talk about the policies and the problems with the policies and the policies not being carried out. What impact should that have on determining the real party in interest here?
So the structure of the complaint here is to lay out the deliberately indifferent policies, and then there's a section of the complaint that goes through each individual defendant and what their personal involvement was with respect to those policies. So the fact that the plaintiffs are challenging unconstitutional conduct by policymakers is not determinative when what the plaintiff is alleging is that these particular supervisors were violating the federal constitution in enacting those policies. And so the fact that the plaintiffs have alleged the personal involvement of the individual defendants is a signal to this court, along with the fact that we called the, you know, we said the individual defendants and not the state. We talked about their personal involvement. Those are the, we're seeking monetary damages. We've made clear from the beginning of the lawsuit that these are personal capacity claims. And so it's not a case where the plaintiff has flip-flopped or there has been some sort of confusion. From the get-go, it's been clear that these are intended to be personal capacity claims. And because they're personal capacity claims, that puts a burden on the plaintiff. The plaintiff will have to show through evidence, including through summary judgment, the personal involvement of the individual defendants and constitutional violations, and we're ready to take on that challenge. The defendants in discovery will have every opportunity to contest the facts and to raise defenses and to say we weren't personally involved or we weren't deliberately indifferent.
So is it the contention that Ex parte Young permits these claims to go forward?
So it's...
It's just not clear if it's official, individual.
Yes, individual capacity. And the main case that we would cite to Your Honor is Hafer v. Malo, and also the Scherr case. But those cases, those were cases for money damages, mm-hmm. alleging personal involvement by the defendants. And in Scherr and Hafer, incidentally, the defendants in those cases were extremely high-ranking state officials. And so, policymakers, one could say. And so the fact that the supervisor is that's being sued for constitutional violations is a very high-ranking official does not provide them protection when they are alleged to have violated the federal constitution.
Now the onto something a bit, well, okay. The defendants have argued that you didn't differentiate between each individual and their specific responsibility and acts, so that the claim cannot be one against the individuals. How do you respond to that argument?
So the plaintiff has put forward multiple paragraphs for individual defendants, depending on their role, laying out very carefully what their roles and their responsibilities and their abilities were. And that's sufficient, along with everything else that we've discussed here, that the claims are labeled as individual against the individual defendants. That's enough for the 11th Amendment immunity issue to be clear. Any further complaints about that the defendants might raise about the allegations in the complaint, those are not properly before this court. This court can't reach the issue of whether there was a failure to state a claim, the inadequate pleadings of personal involvement, because the judgment in this case was a dismissal without prejudice on non-merits grounds. And the defendants, if they wanted to enlarge the judgment to a judgment on the merits, it was incumbent on them to file a cross appeal, which they didn't do.
So, although the defendants have identified some case law where we have nonetheless gone on to address issues outside of sovereign immunity that weren't decided by the trial court. But it sounds like you're arguing if we agree with you on sovereign immunity, it should be remanded for the district court to determine if you've stated a claim and whether or not qualified immunity applies.
That's correct. And also, the cases that the defendants cite for that principle are all cases in which the appellant did not raise the cross-appeal rule, or the cross-appeal rule didn't apply for other reasons. So they have not cited a case in which this court considered the cross-appeal rule and then decided to go forward anyway. There are no such cases because the Supreme Court and the Seventh Circuit have not recognized any exceptions to the cross-appeal rule. And it applies squarely here under the Seventh Circuit's decision in Lewert. And there are other cases as well. We cited to the court the Wright and Miller Federal Practice and Procedure treatise, and that also has additional Seventh Circuit cases applying this.
So would you contend, even before we could answer the qualified immunity questions, there's additional facts that need to be developed?
Yes, so we would contend that this court cannot consider qualified immunity, and also that if for the district court to consider qualified immunity on remand, the qualified immunity inquiry would turn on issues of fact, disputes of fact. And so, at the notice pleading stage, the court's job is to take the allegations pleaded as true and make inferences in the plaintiff's favor. And so the pleading stage is not the time to inject defenses into the pleading. In that kind of a situation, it's not till summary judgment that qualified immunity could be resolved.
Do you want to save your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Janik, whenever you're ready. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Lee Janig here on behalf of the state officials. The plaintiff's 1983 claim seeks damages against 12 high-level state officials for a systemic shortage of appropriate placements for high-needs minors going back decades. These allegations present an official capacity claim for damages because it is targeted at the acts or omissions of a state agency, and therefore it is barred by the 11th Amendment.
Hypothetically, if your client said tomorrow, we'll settle this suit with our own money from our own pockets and give the plaintiffs all of the compensatory damages they are asking for, but we won't ask the agency to change any policies or work toward that end, this lawsuit would go away, wouldn't it? And isn't that a sign that this is a suit against the individual defendants and not the state?
You're correct, Your Honor, that the lawsuit would go away, but that's not a sign that this is a lawsuit against the individuals, because then I think new plaintiffs, or even in fact these same plaintiffs, could just bring another lawsuit for a new time period and say, this is still happening, this agency is still doing this thing, therefore, we're still entitled to damages. And I think to kind of illustrate that sort of on the flip side, if a different person were to take one of these jobs tomorrow, I think under the plaintiff's theory, they would be immediately liable for damages unless they somehow fixed this long-term problem.
How would they be able to slide in? Yeah, if another person comes into that high-ranking position, and so it's your contingent, I want to make sure I got this right, is that the lawsuit would continue, but just against the new office holder?
I think that would sort of functionally be the same thing. You know, in an official capacity claim, you have, the lawsuit is against the office. And so if a plaintiff is able to just keep bringing the same lawsuits over and over against whoever is in the office, that's functionally an official capacity claim. And, you know,
a plaintiff cannot, circumvent the sovereign immunity just by plugging in the names of individual defendants.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And so is that the contention is what would be happening here?
Yes, Your Honor. I think everyone agrees that a claim against state officials in their personal capacity is not barred, and the claim against them in their official capacity is barred. And the question is, how does one assess what capacity a defendant is sued in, where, as here, the plaintiffs didn't specify in their complaint? Uh-huh. And the Supreme Court's answered that by saying you look to who is the real party in interest. Is the claim really targeting the agency, or is it targeting, something that these individuals personally did?
You say that the plaintiffs are simply looking to change how the state has chosen to allocate its resources. But isn't it just as fair to say that the plaintiffs want money to compensate children who have suffered harm? Maybe the plaintiffs need that money for therapy, for psychological harm, or for private tutors to catch up educationally for time out of school, or to take the family on a vacation for, lost time with siblings. In other words, they say they want money. Why should we believe them?
They do say they want money, Your Honor, but you're not able to get money, compensatory damages, against the state. That's the rule of the 11th Amendment. So the question, and as the Supreme Court has said, we're not, in assessing the real party in interest, one does not simply look to the relief sought. If that were true, then there would essentially be no rule against official capacity claims for damages, because merely seeking damages would convert a claim into a personal capacity claim.
So what do you think the test is? I'm troubled by the fact that the district court followed the Fourth Circuit in Martin and Cunningham with a test that we've never adopted, and which the Fourth Circuit itself has said doesn't apply in this context, namely 1983 cases. But what... So don't tell me that test. What do you think the test for determining the real party in interest should be?
So the test is to look at the substance of the allegations and determine whether the claim is being targeted at the agency or the individuals, who are named in the complaint.
And a significant piece of that is relief, the relief sought. The Supreme Court has said that, we've said that. But what else besides relief sought?
Sure, so it is, we acknowledge that this is a fact-specific test.
It is.
That is gonna depend on what kind of claim is being brought. But here, to go through kind of the allegations in their complaint.
I guess I'm looking for what test we should apply. It is very fact-dependent, and we have said that, the court has said that, but in assessing those facts, what's the test you're asking us to apply?
So some of the relevant factors that are present here are the fact that they're suing every person who's held a particular job with no differentiation between them. And again, if a different person were to step into one of those jobs, I think, under their theory, they would be automatically liable. Another, indicia is, whether the defendants have the power to fix the problem that they are kind of presenting as the constitutional violation. Here, they have these allegations in their complaint that, first of all, there are sort of conclusory allegations that these defendants just have the authority to somehow fix this decades-long problem. And under the court's pleading standards, that's not sufficient. Then they also have these allegations that, you know, the defendants can spend whatever fund is necessary to, you know, alleviate this problem. That's in paragraph 88. And that's simply not a plausible allegation, again, under this court's pleading standards. State, you know, state agencies have budgets. There's a whole apparatus of allocating funds in this way. They don't allege anything that these individuals kind of have that power to make that change.
Can we look to maybe Orr or Hill for the test?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think Orr and Hill kind of reflect that these are fact-specific tests that look at, you know, what is being, you know what kind of actual conduct or omissions are being alleged and who's ultimately causing that.
You've said that they don't have the power to fix it, but I think what the plaintiffs would say is they're not asking to fix it. They are asking for damages against your clients for exasperating these problems or making
the
problems
inaction.
Worse.
Right, they're alleging that there's inaction.
Yes. So why isn't that enough? At the pleading stage, why isn't that enough?
Because they have also, they in their complaint, they have alleged that this is a decades-long, systemic, widespread problem. You know, and we acknowledge that in some situations, you know, it's reasonable.
They want to get money for their plaintiffs. And if that ends up encouraging someone to change the system, well, that would be great, too. I mean, that would be fine with them, too. Can't you have both, in other words? Can't both be true?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the, you know, the 11th Amendment does not permit compensatory damages against a state agency. So that's really, you know, why it requires looking beyond not just the relief sought, but also what's actually alleged in their complaint.
If they had alleged that these were personal capacity only claims, would that satisfy you?
I don't think it would, Your Honor. And that was the Gerlach case where this court said that, you know, even though it's labeled as an individual capacity claim, we can see that it is not. And that's, you know, again, this broader principle that the court needs to look beyond labels, as it does in, you know, many pleading contexts. You know, this is not kind of breaking new ground or adopting a new test like the plaintiffs are suggesting. But, you know, again, it's the plaintiff's complaint that has alleged that this is a widespread systemic problem. And, you know, in that context, it's not reasonable to infer that any one of these individuals kind of has the power to fix it, which is what they're asking the court, you know, and they're asking the court to just accept that as true because we're at the pleading stage. But at the pleading stage, the court does not accept allegations that are not well pleaded.
You know, I think of it like a torts case. If a plaintiff trips on an uneven sidewalk and gets hurt, she might sue for the money she needs for medical bills and lost work and rehabilitation, but it might also have the effect of encouraging the property owner to fix the sidewalk so no one else gets hurt. And the plaintiff might also be very happy about that outcome, but that would not change the nature of the tort suit for compensatory damages, would it?
No, Your Honor, but again, the 11th Amendment forecloses compensatory damages against a state. But I would add, Your Honor, that the plaintiffs do have recourse here. You know, there is a consent decree that controls, you know, many of the department's operations, including this one. And if the plaintiffs are dissatisfied with the way that that is being implemented, they have remedies within that process.
Can they obtain monetary damages through that consent decree process?
No, Your Honor, because they cannot obtain monetary damages against the state. But I think that that's what this claim is trying to do, is it's trying to go, you know, sort of take essentially the same problems that are being addressed there and use them to get monetary damages, which is not permitted. You know, this kind of, you know, systemic widespread problem is the quintessential official capacity claim. And, you know, under the Supreme Court's longstanding case law, that cannot be remedied by compensatory damages. It can only be remedied by prospective relief. which again is available here. Unless the court has any further questions on this, this 11th Amendment topic, you know, I would just briefly add that if the court declines to affirm on this ground, you know, we submit that it should affirm because the complaint also fails to state a claim.
Are we able to do that if there's no cross appeal?
Yes.
Entertain the alternative grounds?
Yes, Your Honor, because the cross appeal rule is not jurisdictional and the court has relaxed it in some circumstances, including when there are immunities, you know, at issue, as there is here. That was essentially the issue, what happened in Doyle, where there was an 11th Amendment dismissal and the court affirmed on qualified immunity grounds. But if the court disagrees, then, you know, and does not want to relax the cross appeal rule here, then the correct, you know, the appropriate course would be to remand to the district court to consider those arguments in the first instance.
Would you concede that Judge Packhold, in relying on the Martin test, was wrong?
We agree that Martin is not the test that the court applies here. As we note in our brief, there is some overlap. It's not some, you know, completely, you know, out of left field kind of thing, but we agree that Martin does not apply here. If the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Brown.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a few points. The correct rule is to focus on the nature of the relief that's requested and the allegations of personal involvement by the defendants, to look at the fact that the plaintiff has sought punitive and compensatory damages, but the plaintiff asserted in the complaint that the claim was against the individual defendants and expressly not against the state. And the cases like Gerlach that the defendants have raised or that the district court relied on are all different because they are not seeking monetary damages for personal involvement in constitutional torts. They're borderline cases where what the plaintiff is seeking is some sort of specific monies that are in the hands of the state. So
what about Ms. Jonick's argument though that the constitutional wrong here really, based on the allegations, is a result of systemic problems. And these individual defendants can't fix those systemic problems.
So that is reading a defense into the complaint that departs from the allegations in the complaint, which are exactly to the opposite. So it is true that the plaintiff says that this problem existed prior to the defendants coming to office, but the complaint also says that the problem exploded under their care and describes that. And the fact that a supervisor comes into a role and is aware that there are prior constitutional violations and then you know, has notice, has an ability and opportunity to enact policies and practices that are not deliberately indifferent to that risk, they don't get a pass just because their predecessor also violated the Constitution. And in fact, you know, if this lawsuit was mostly brought against former state officials, not the current officials in the roles. In fact, I think only two, maybe something like two of the 12 defendants are still in their roles. And plaintiffs are suing the individuals that we named in the complaint for their conduct, what they did. The idea that...
So you would disagree with the connotation that the names are somewhat interchangeable?
That's correct. The plaintiffs have alleged that the conduct worsened, the problem exploded under these defendants' watch. And the idea that just because a supervisor comes in and continues an unconstitutional policy that would immunize them or somehow trigger 11th Amendment immunity is not a workable rule, and it's not a rule that appears in the case law. And then one final point two final points, Your Honors. The case law is very clear in cases like Brokaw and Duckworth and Walker and Thomas that the plaintiff has a choice whether they're pleading personal capacity claims or official capacity claims. Plaintiffs here have made their choice clear. And because they have sued personal capacity, they've asserted personal capacity claims, that means they will have to prove personal involvement by the individual defendants. And as a final point,
You can finish your final point.
I apologize. As a final point, the defendants have asked this court to apply an exception to the cross-appeal rule, but they've forfeited any such argument by failing to raise that in their responsive brief such that we could have responded. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Thank you, Ms. Johnick. Thanks for the strong advocacy on both sides. The court will take the case under advisement.